You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, August 3rd, 2023, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, everyone.
Kara, you got your power back.
I did. It's still pouring. It's not still. It did stop, but it is again pouring down rain outside. Florida weather is out of control. I got to drive in it for the first time a couple days ago in like a torrential downpour with lightning. So that was new. Speaking of something new in Florida, there's breaking news right now.
I was
just sharing it on social. A statement was just released by the College Board that said, and for those who aren't, I guess, in America, the College Board, I guess, regulates things like the SAT, right? The College Board regulates the SAT, AP course placement, AP meaning advanced placement, which are the courses you take at the high school level to get college credit or to be able to skip certain courses, like introductory courses in college. Okay. So they just put out a statement that says, quote, "We are sad to have learned that today the Florida Department of Education has effectively banned AP psychology in the state by instructing Florida superintendents that teaching foundational content on sexual orientation and gender identity is illegal under state law. The state has said districts are free to teach AP psychology only if it excludes any mention of these essential topics." But then the statement goes on to say that these topics have been in the curriculum for the last 30 years and that it's required to prepare individuals for college-level courses in psychology and ultimately for careers in this field, and that they are unwilling to take it out of the curriculum because they see it as necessary and foundational. So for that reason, basically, kids in Florida now won't be able to take AP psychology.
Oh, unbelievable. Wow.
Mm-hmm. It won't be offered, which means that if I had come up in this state now, I would not be able to prepare for my own career starting in high school.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to have generations of people coming out of Florida who will not be able, will unlikely go on to careers in psychology.
Possibly. Or they will have to learn all of this stuff from scratch at the university level.
Yeah.
And hopefully they're going to a university that is not private where, you know.
Right.
But even then, the APA accredits a lot of these things. So, if they're going to want to be practicing psychologists, they're going to have to go to an APA accredited
I know it's only one state, but it's a horrible thing. In a country that is completely suffering from a lack of mental health professionals, to limit this type of education, we should be encouraging people to get into this career because of how few practitioners there are out there to help people, because we're having a mental health crisis in the United States right now.
Definitely need more healthcare people. Definitely.
Absolutely. And from a broader perspective, we have to remember as well that this is not the only academic endeavor that's struggling in Florida due to restrictions on what can be taught. And so we're seeing that just like fewer and fewer ideas are being openly shared and expressed because of these types of restrictions, which is just worrisome for education as a whole. Education should be more open, not more restrictive.
Governments shouldn't be using education as a political football,
we're not the ones getting political. Education should be open.
But
what if it's but to push back on that a little, what if it's a referendum? Like, what if it's, the public clamoring for it? Should it then be a political issue?
Well, that's really complicated because the whole issue of like parents should have input into the education of their own kids in public school. Yeah, I will agree with that in principle. Should they have absolute power? No. Should one parent have a veto over all other parents? No. That's the way it's being set up in Florida. One crank can ruin it for everybody, basically. The laws are deliberately vague in order to intimidate teachers so that they avoid entire subject areas. Mm-hmm. Because it's a landmine, and they can get like fired and even go to jail in some cases.
Yeah,
it's ridiculous.
And we've got to remember too that like referendum or not, public education is protected by the Constitution. And what we're talking about here is public school. We're talking about individuals with the least amount of power and the least, the kind of quietest voices having access to free and unfettered education. If a parent doesn't want their child to learn something, they can send their child to public or to private school. If they can't afford private school, they can send their child to a charter. There are a million loopholes available, but to restrict public education is exactly what you're saying, Steve. It's the voice of a loud few telling everyone else what they are and are not allowed to learn, very often based on ideological reasons. And that's really disconcerting. Really disconcerting.
Yeah.
Public education should be free and open. The ethic of education is the free exchange of ideas. That's the point of education.
Yeah, yeah.
It's to open your mind and to learn things.
You know, I would imagine that a lot of this is motivated by people's personal religions. I think it's like – this seems so basic in such like a – like you should know this. Everybody should know this. But your religion limits you as an individual, as a practitioner of that religion. It doesn't limit me, the other person who doesn't partake in your religion, right? It seems so basic, but – you know, religious people seem to be, you know, wanting to, you know, certain religions seem to be very much wanting to express like what their beliefs are and what they believe in as a practitioner of the religion on other people.
Well, I mean, this is the principle of separation of church and state. You can't have freedom of religion unless you have freedom from other people imposing their religion on you.
Yes.
And but this isn't the worst violation of church and state in education recently. I think it's Oklahoma is trying to pass a law that says that that charter schools can be run by religious organizations. So basically, taxpayer-funded public schools, right? Taxpayer-funded public schools can be religious. And that's a blatant violation of the separation of church and state.
But it's clearly a long game that's already been played with. That's what charter schools – I don't want to say it's the only function of charter schools, but charter schools have long been utilized as a loophole to get taxpayer funding towards ostensibly private education.
Right.
And so that is – I mean, it's disconcerting, but I'm also not surprised by it. And I mean, obviously, we're not comparing like what's worse, but like this is not a law that's been floated. This is happening right now.
Yeah.
This is happening. That's really, really scary. This is like – 1984 stuff, you know,
right?
Like, we got to be open our eyes to it. And I think we've got to not minimize it by saying, oh, it's just political. It's not political. It is political, but
it's being politicized.
In the sense that everything is political. You know what I mean? These are people's lives that we're talking about. These are children who are not able to learn about reality.
Yeah. I think that's why people get so, you know, uptight about it, because it is children, it's their children, and I get that, but there's got to be, again, this gets back to the deeper point, is there needs to be certain things that we can agree on as a society. You know, like, what are facts? Like, what are the facts? Let's talk about something lighter.
Yeah, what does science know?
What is
stupid psychology?
For my birthday last weekend, we had like a party at a glass blowing forge.
That was fun.
Oh, that's fun. What'd you guys make? Did you make stuff yourselves?
Yeah.
Kind of. They're doing the work, and they like let you hold the piece of wood, or they let you spin the pipe or blow into the pipe. You know, so they have like an array of like what, Steve, about 10 different things that you can make: glasses, vase,
and
you know,
harmonica.
Paperweight.
Yeah.
Yeah. So most of us made like a short whiskey glass type of thing, like a heavy,
I don't even drink whiskey.
Heavy glass. And we got all the glass this week, and oh my God, everybody's piece was gorgeous.
Oh, I love that. It just reminds me what you were about to say of like when I was in Eswatini, there was a charitable organization where they hand carve these beautiful spoons, and they're teaching the kids who live in this orphanage to learn how to whittle and how to carve. And so I was talking to the guy about it, and I was like, the kids made this? And he was like, they helped. Just like, the cutest way that he was like, yeah, they made that. They're learning.
Well, the thing is, glass blowing is always at least a two-person thing anyway. You know, like there always has to be an assistant. You can't do it by yourself, you know.
Now, and that's so, where robots would come in handy.
So basically, we were the assistant.
Right.
And they were telling us what to do. Anything that took any skill, they did. right?
That's so fun, though.
The biggest thing we did was get to choose. We get to design it. Like, we get to choose what we wanted to make and what colors and colors, you know, just all the design elements of it. And they did let us, like, my younger daughter, Autumn, wanted to make a pumpkin, and that wasn't one of the things that they were offering. But they let her do it, and it was amazing. I mean, absolutely amazing.
That's cool.
Thing. Yeah, it was really, really good.
You know what I bet the most requested thing there is that they probably don't let you do?
What's that?
Animals.
A pipe.
No, oh, yeah. Well, it's not that wasn't one of the options.
Exactly. People yeah. are like, can yeah. I make a pipe? And that's they're right. like, no, read the sign.
A hash pipe, yeah.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, I was looking for the bongs. I didn't see any.
Exactly.
They were hippies. They were definitely self-proclaimed hippies.
Oh, they had
hippies.
Them in the back. Yeah. They're behind a curtain.
Yeah, but it was a fun, different kind of thing to do for like a birthday party. And I want to explore more of those things, like just like spending an afternoon doing something, you know, artsy or, you know, crafty like that.
Build-A-Bear.
Experiences, not things.
Yeah. Yes. A few years ago, I rented out a shop, like, you know, those like paint and party or like color me mine kind of places. Do you guys have anything like that where you paint the pottery? The pottery's already made, but you paint it and then they glaze it and then they fire it for you?
No,
I know of what you speak, but I've not done it.
There's a place like that close to my house in LA that was like an adult, like a grown-up version where it was all cool stuff like robots and dinosaurs and stuff.
Cool.
And it was BYOB and we had it catered with food. And yeah, just a bunch of my friends came and we like painted really cool stuff, like kitchen stuff or like little piggy banks. And it was a really fun way to spend the night. I felt like we were all bonding.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a bonding experience.
Like, yeah, you know, it wasn't just like a dinner.
You're doing something where there's a directive, you know, like you have a goal, something that's creative. You're also learning. I did that thing where you go in and like the person up front teaches everyone how to make this particular painting, you know, and those classes are a ton of fun. I mean, it's half the fun is watching 90% of the room do a horrible job at painting.
Happy little trees.
100%. Yeah.
So mine suck too, but you know, but still, it's a really interesting thing to do. I got to tell you, I learned something. I learned that those glass furnaces are
hot.
Unbelievably stinking hot. Like when they opened that door, I was 20 feet away from the furnace.
Oh, you were blown away.
Oh, they opened the door. It was a quarter of the temperature of the surface of the sun. A quarter. Yeah.
But you feel the heat instantly.
It's 2100 degrees.
As far, you know, maybe it isn't instant. It seems instant. Like the guy opened the door and all of a sudden just felt like a Balrog was in your face.
Yeah. Did you guys have to sign waivers?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Basically, if anything happens to you, it's your fault.
Wow. Okay.
But it was a really great experience. And it was fun because you got to watch. Not only did you get to do it, but you got to watch everybody else do it.
Yeah.
So we have lots
crafts are cool. Crafts are fun.
We have a collection of really funny pictures of all of us blowing into like that steel rod. You know, you got to everybody had a really, really ugly picture of themselves like doing this thing. It was really great.
That's awesome.
And you walk away with a little souvenir that
you get the glass.
That you actually participated in the creation of it.
Neat.
So I'm looking for other ideas like that.
Yeah.
You know. All right. Well, let's move on with our show. Carrie, you're going to start us off with a what's the word?
Word.
I am. I'm still not fully clear on the pronunciation of this word. I think it's mereology.
Oh, it's interesting. It's spelled M-E-R-E-O-L-O-G-Y.
Yeah.
Whereas the word mirror, you would not pronounce the E, but in here you do pronounce the E.
I don't
know.
Second E. I could be wrong. It could be mirology. That's why I really haven't
two
been able to quite
together
figure it
like
out.
That. Yeah.
I like mereology, so that's what I'm going to say. Oh, guess who recommended this? Our friend Visto Tutti.
Oh,
Visto.
Wow. He's all over the place.
Yeah, right?
He's
punk.
He said it's actually quite fun. He said, I came across this word maybe for the first time in a discussion of ants. Because, you know, that's what we do is we have discussions about ants. Is an ant a being or is only a colony a being? Where is the information stored in an ant colony? And so he was like, this word comes up in sociology, epidemiology, and veterinary science, although that one may be a typo. mereology, the theory of parthood relations. And that's a really good description right there. It's a theory of parthood relations, or the relations of the part to whole and the relations of part to part. So mereology is heavily discussed in philosophy. That's most of the citations that I found are in philosophy, specifically kind of within the discussion of ontology. So the idea here, and I've got a few things pulled up. We'll start maybe with the etymology. Oh, I looked up how to pronounce this guy's name, and I know I'm going to butcher it. It was coined by, to my Polish listeners, I'm so sorry, Stanisław Leśniewski, maybe.
Sounds good to me.
Thanks. I'm sure I butchered that really bad. It comes from the Greek root for part, which is meros, and of course, ology, logy, you know, that's the science of something or the study of something. So there's a million ologies out there. Actually, a good friend of mine has a podcast called Ologies. I highly recommend it.
Cool.
And she interviews different ologists every week, which is quite fun. But mereology, in kind of formal logic, is the discipline that deals with the relationships of parts with their respective wholes. Sometimes you'll see that people will discuss it as the study of wholes and parts, but that's not really true. It's really just the study of how parts and wholes relate to one another. And so obviously there are a lot of related terms like that we'll see in literature or like poetry. Like, what are some examples? Like gestalt or synecdoche. Like, these are different terms that relate to this idea, but it's actually quite a deep philosophical investigation that started very, very early, that describes parthood relations. Like, how do these things work together to make up a whole, and what arises from that? And sometimes it'll be discussed almost like as related to but alternative from taxonomy, which would be the discussion of the individual parts, kind of discrete units. Here we're talking about the wholeness, the relationship of the parts to the wholeness. And it's quite abstract, but not. I find it fascinating. I love this stuff. You see it in ontology, like I said. You see it a bit in phenomenology and in a lot of different philosophers' writings. So yeah, mereology.
Would you say the Borg is an example of mereology? Bob, Jay, and Steve, would you say the Borg is an example of mereology?
Mm. The study of how the parts relate to the whole?
Yes.
I guess so, in the way like the
bees are
to a hive.
Yeah. Right. Well, yeah, sure.
Is it like a hive mind kind of a thing?
Yeah, it's a hive mind.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I would think that a hive mind would be a great example of that kind of grappling.
Neat.
Cool.
Now it has a term.
It's fascinating.
All right, thanks, Kara. Bob.
Yep.
Yeah.
Tell us about glass-coated DNA.
Oh, you blew some at the party the other day, right, for Steve?
Yes. Glass and DNA.
Challenging.
Researchers claim to have engineered a new material that's surprisingly strong and, at the same time, very, very light. But even more shocking is the fact of what it's made of. It's made of DNA and glass. So Siak Wu Lee is a material scientist at the University of Connecticut. He and his colleagues from UConn, Columbia University, and Brookhaven National Lab reported on their research in Cell Reports Physical Science. So, all right, how do you slap together DNA and glass and end up with something that's the opposite of squishy and brittle? What did they do this? What was their process? Let's start with the DNA component. They used strings of DNA that were coated in such a way that they self-assembled into essentially an inherently strong and lightweight 3D shape called a lattice. In this case, it's a nanolattice. And this has been done many times before, so there's really nothing new there. The next step, though, was the special one. The next step was to coat just the DNA comprising the lattices with glass. So now when you think of glass, what do you think? You think fragile. You think it shatters very easily. And it does, because there's always flaws in the glass. There's going to be a crack. There's going to be like a scratch or maybe even some missing atoms in its molecular structure. Any one of those things would be enough to make it shatter very easily. And that's why they do shatter very easily, is because it's not flawless glass. It's flawed. So now, but how do you get around that? If you make a small enough piece of glass, something on the scale of like a micrometer. No, micrometer, isn't it?
No, micrometer's fine also.
I thought micrometer.
Micrometer? Both are acceptable.
Okay. Yeah. I don't like it, though. Then I'll go micrometer.
Yeah, then
micrometer.
Say micrometer.
All right.
So it's just, that sounds a little more like transformers, but you can say it.
Micrometer to me sounds like a device. Here's the micrometer. It's not a unit of length in my mind, in my stupid mind. All right. But if you make a small enough piece of glass on the scale of a micrometer, that's a millionth of a meter, then it won't have any of those flaws because that is what is going to make it incredibly strong. No flaws means immensely strong. So how strong is this stuff that's flawless? A cubic centimeter of such a glass could withstand 10 tons of pressure.
Wow.
Cubic centimeter, 10 tons on 1 cubic centimeter, no problem. Well, maybe a little bit of a problem, but they can go as high as 10 tons. So now the researchers coated the DNA lattice with a thin layer of glass, only a few hundred atoms thick, so quite thin. So now we have, what do we have? Two things. We have an inherently strong lattice shape made of DNA that's coated with very strong, flawless glass. And since only the DNA was covered with the lattice, that means that there was a lot of large empty voids. So you end up with a material that's both lightweight and amazingly strong at the same time. Now, if you find this on the news, you're going to hear these numbers tossed around all over the place. You'll see it's 4 times stronger than steel and 5 times less dense. Now, I don't know why they say 5 times less dense instead of just 1/5 like in most people, I think. But I'm not even going to get pulled into that debate. I saw too many debates online. Whatever. I know what they mean. So Siak Wulu said, he said, for the given density, our material is the strongest known. So big claim. But to me, the most interesting question after this was how. How can this material be both strong and light at the same time? And because it seems obvious, right, that if you increase one, the other one is going to decrease. So how do you increase both of them at the same time? And the answer to that comes back to something that we have discussed many times on the show. What is it? Metamaterials. This is a metamaterial. Now, metamaterials have been the darlings of material science for a while now. They're just so fascinating. They're engineered artificial materials that have the ability to transcend what we see in nature, right? They go beyond nature. And that's really their defining characteristics, that you can't see these behaviors in nature. Even after billions of years of R&D, they don't use this technique, if you will. So the properties of a metamaterial depend not on its chemical nature, but on its microstructure. That's what's important, not the chemical nature like everything else that in your environment that you interact with. The arrangement of the engineered nanoscale components of the material, that's what determines its properties. Now, we've seen most often, and we've discussed it many times on the show, what metamaterials can do with light, right? The way it can bend light, it can manipulate light in ways that we never see in nature. Now, how many times have I read about, you know, bizarre invisibility cloaks using metamaterials that not visible light, but, you know, X-rays and other.
17?
Yes.
2.
I thought it was 15, but I believe 17. So that's got to be 95% of what I've read about metamaterials. So it's all interacting with light. Well, this is different. These DNA nanolattices are, so they're metamaterials, but they're mechanical metamaterials. So it's no surprise, since they're a metamaterial, that we're seeing such exotic mechanical properties with these nanolattices. Okay, so in the future, what are we going to see in the future here? We're going to see these scientists are going to be experimenting with different DNA configurations. But more importantly, I think they're going to be using carbide ceramics instead of glass to see if they can make this even stronger, which may be hard because I think what they're seeing is close to the theoretical maximum of what you could expect with these materials. It's so amazingly strong and light that it's going to be hard to really make any significant improvements over that. Now, it's also very hard to say where you're going to use this material, right? Because strength and weight, that's really what these articles are focusing on. And even the research is kind of hard to get through that the dense jargon in the paper. But they mention more than anything else strength and weight. But these are, Steve, I'm sure you're going to agree with me here, these are just two of the many critical characteristics that you need to be concerned with a new metamaterial. There's shear strength, there's tensile strength, there's hardness, there's toughness, there's ductility, there's melting point, there's wear resistance, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's a long list. And all of those characteristics determine what a material is good for. So I don't know where this one's going to pan out and what things are going to be focused on in terms of like what kind of uses it's going to be good for. So I think we'll see. But I think this definitely is an interesting advance that's not going to just like go away. I think we're going to see some interesting ramifications to this. Siak Wu Lee said, now this quote kills me because you know that when they interviewed him, they loved this quote because it talks about Iron Man. So every article I read throws this back out. So this is what he said. He's like, I've always wondered how to create a better armor for Iron Man. It must be very light for him to fly faster. It must be very strong to protect him from enemies' attacks. Our new material is 5 times lighter, but 4 times stronger than steel. So our glass nanolattices would be much better than any other structural materials to create an improved armor for Iron Man. So I'll just end it with the Iron Man quote. So interesting advance here. I love mechanical metamaterials.
Now, here's the thing.
Yeah.
Whenever they say that it's stronger than steel.
Yep. That's almost a nonsense statement, right? It's just like, really?
Yeah.
That's,
are they talking about specific strength
yep.
or absolute strength? They're usually talking about specific strength.
Yep. Like, absolutely.
Meaning strength per weight, per mass, as opposed to just its absolute strength.
Right.
That's the case here.
And I think they are. And also they tested this at scale. I mean, this was very, very, very small sample that they tested. So, you know, when you extrapolate that up, I mean, how is that going to impact the strength? And depending on the exact type of strength they tested, I don't know. This is very preliminary, and I still think we don't know. There's no way that they're going to, you know, I think scale this up soon and have something that still is, you know, much stronger than steel and much lighter. Except in maybe in a very limited domain of what you would call strength, right? Whether it's specific strength or I don't know what else.
And the other thing you always have to think about is this a laboratory curiosity? Is there any way plausibly to mass produce this stuff?
Yeah, I was just going to say that. I mean, if we, you know, Bob, are they making like tiny little specks of this, or do they make a chunk of it?
No, these are small amounts that they're making. They're basically just testing the concept of, you know, let's do this origami DNA nanolattice and let's create that, but then coat it with flawless glass and see how strong it is. And it is very strong, and it's stronger than anything that's ever been tested in this way. But I mean, this is a lattice. What they have is a very, very strong lattice structure. And that's something that's just like, you know, lattices are a thing. I mean, lattices are in engineering throughout the world. I mean, that those shapes are known and they're important. So I think there's probably a decent chance that this will scale and find some utility in some application. But who knows, you know, what the environment would be, or, you know, maybe it's not good with heat, or maybe it wears too much, and that's going to impact what it's going to be applied to. But we're talking, you know, battery technology, superconductors. There's lots of possibilities for something like this.
All right, Jay, tell us how these heat waves are going to kill us.
Yeah, you know, it's been really an interesting roller coaster ride that we've all been on in the United States this summer. We had some really extreme heat. I mean, there was a week there where I was looking at the heat map of the United States, and they projected throughout the week, this is where the extreme heat was going to be. And, you know, the lower half of the United States was in either the danger or extreme danger zone. And I wanted to learn what that was. What does that mean? You know, what's the heat index? Because you read about the heat index, and I wanted to learn more about that. So the question is that I'm gonna answer tonight for you guys is, how bad is this extreme heat to people? Because it's not just the United States that's experiencing this. You know, global warming is happening everywhere, and extreme heat is happening everywhere. So the short answer is, extreme heat is very bad. That's largely because humans, you know, live in a very narrow temperature range that we're comfortable in and that our bodies function well in. You know, like 70 degrees, you know, Fahrenheit is like the, you know, like that's a nice little average temperature that most people are comfortable at. But, you know, if you go up 20 degrees above that, you could start having heat problems. You know, that is not a big temperature change. So nearly 210 million Americans, or 2/3 of the population, live in counties that have temperature hot enough to cause harm. So that is due to global warming. Now that figure wasn't the same, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago. Heat is the number one weather-related killer. That blew my mind. You know, you think, oh wow, you know, what about tornadoes and you know, hurricanes and floods? You could add up all of the other weather-related events, and they don't even come close to what heat does as far as killing people and the danger that is caused by it. So it's been asked if the extreme heat is linked to climate change. You know, people are, you know, this question is still being thrown around. You know, if you're listening to this show, you probably know the answer is, of course, yes. But to give you a more formal answer, climatologists agree that this summer extreme heat is 100% due to global warming. The World Weather Attribution Collaboration analyzed the heat changes that happened, or, you know, they're constantly analyzing all, you know, all of the weather. And what they have discovered is that it's actually impossible for these temperatures to exist without climate change. So how bad is the heat now? How bad was it this summer? So this summer in the United States, the heat levels were exceptionally high. Phoenix, Arizona had 31 straight days above 110 degrees or 43 degrees Celsius. This crushed the previous record, which was 18 days. So we went from 18 days to 31 days with 110 degrees. Death Valley, California experienced a scorching temperature of 130 degrees Fahrenheit or 54 degrees Celsius. That is not the hottest temperature that's ever been there. But the thing to note here is how consistent the heat was at these high temperatures. You know, it stayed there for a long time where, you know, in the past, it might reach a temperature one day and it's a very brief experience. You know, now, you know, it persists and that makes things very dangerous. There was a span of a week where a huge portion of the southern part of the U.S. was labeled in the danger of or extreme danger temperature categories. And I'm going to explain this to you guys in a minute. Heat records were broken all across the country. This tracks with the fact that last month was the planet's hottest June by a significant margin. The nine hottest Junes have all occurred in the last 9 years. Global warming, right? Crazy. Yeah. Scary. Mm. Scary and legitimately scary. You know, this isn't like, you know, we're not watching a movie here. This is real. You've all probably heard of the heat index. I wanted to talk about this. Steve and I were having a nice conversation about the heat index. So the heat
is the story of my life right now, Jay. The heat index is cruel and punishing.
But let's, yeah, it was a heated conversation.
Let's talk about what it means so people understand it a little bit better and can wrap their head around what's happening here. The heat index is what the temperature feels like to a human body when relative humidity is combined with the air temperature. So the higher the humidity, the lower the temperature needs to be in order for it to be dangerous. So humidity mixed with heat is bad. So if it's, you know, you could be in 100 degrees and if the relative humidity, say, is at 20%, it's not that bad. You know, most people can sustain that without a problem. But if the relative humidity was 70%, at 100 degrees, you're in danger at that point. So the humidity has a huge impact on just how bad the heat actually feels. Now, if we take a look at the heat index, it shows that temperatures starting at 90 degrees Fahrenheit or 32 degrees Celsius can cause heat exhaustion and heat stroke in some people like the elderly. So even at this considerably, you know, pretty low temperature, 90 degrees Fahrenheit, 32 degrees Celsius, we're not talking like, it's not a scorcher. But already, you know, the elderly or people that have, you know, medical conditions, asthma as an example, that type of thing, you know, you could go right to the worst forms of danger that heat can cause, heat exhaustion and heat stroke. And I'm going to tell you about that as well, because I think it's important for people to know the details. When the temperature gets to 103 degrees Fahrenheit or 39 degrees Celsius, heat exhaustion is likely to happen in healthy people with prolonged exposure. So already at 103 degrees, you know, heat exhaustion, which is bad, can happen to any of us.
That's true 103 degrees or with the heat index?
The heat index in the 103 degree zone, right?
Yeah.
So when the heat index gets to 125 degrees Fahrenheit or 51 degrees Celsius, it warns that heat stroke is likely. And you know what? 125 degrees was not that uncommon this past summer. We're already there. We're already at like the, you're going to get heat stroke. Anything above 125 degrees, you really shouldn't even think about going outside. Doesn't matter what age you are. Doesn't matter what health you're in. It's just dangerous. And a thing I found out about the heat index is all of these temperature numbers, they're assuming that you're in the shade.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I didn't know that. It's like if you're exposed to direct sunlight, it's even worse. It's already, you know, you're already in a situation where it's bad in the shade. You walk out into the sun and things will happen faster to you.
I had to, like, before I got my truck, which was just a week or two ago, when I was walking to and from work every day, I found myself having to walk under my umbrella.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I had to.
Yeah.
If I didn't open my umbrella, I was like, sweat was pouring off my body. And like you mentioned, I'm living in a place where the humidity is regularly 80 degrees or 80%.
Yeah, yeah, it's bad.
So it does not evaporate and it doesn't cool you off. You're just wet all the time.
Exactly, exactly. When I get into the heat related illnesses, you know, ooh, I'm going to really explain this.
Scary.
So let's do it right now. So there, all right. So there's different things that can happen to you in heat. There's mild heat related illnesses like heat cramps. These are pretty common. Heat cramps are typical in people who sweat a lot. Sweating depletes the body of what? Salt and water, right? So this can lead to muscle pains, spasms, usually in the abdomen, arms, or legs. So that's a sign you need to get some fluids that have, you know, some electrolytes in them, right? But you're okay. You can get, you know, this type of, you know, this mild heat, tight heat cramps or whatever. You know, you're not going to die from that. It's your body's telling you, go get some liquids. Another thing that's common is heat rash. This is caused by sweating. You know, sweating can cause skin irritations in hot and humid weather. It's most common in young children, and it looks like red clusters of pimples or blisters. You know, it tends to be in places around the neck, upper chest, you know, in elbow creases. And again, this is a warning sign. You see this, you got to do something about it right away. Now, moving up a notch here, heat exhaustion is the body's response to an excessive loss of water and salt. Now, usually through sweating, of course. Heat exhaustion is most likely to affect the elderly, people with high blood pressure, or people who are typically working outside or exposed to the sun in these hot environments. If you get heat exhaustion, you're going to feel it. You're going to feel tired. You might even get some confusion happening. And if that's happening to you, then you need to move indoors immediately and you need to hydrate immediately. But the big gun here is heat stroke. And I didn't really know what heat stroke was. I've heard about it my entire life, and I just never read about it before. Now, heat stroke happens when a person's body can no longer cool itself. And now what your body does is when it detects that it's hot outside and it needs to cool itself, the body increases your heart rate, right? Your heart rate is pumping your blood through all your organs and all your tissue, and then your body will start to sweat, and that sweat will evaporate off of your skin and cool your body because evaporation has a cooling effect. Now, when this happens, the body's temperature, if you are getting heat stroke, what's happening is you're in an environment where your sweat is no longer working. It's no longer able to cool you because of either the humidity is too high or it's just flat out too hot for your body's cooling mechanism to actually work because it only works up to a certain temperature and then it's irrelevant at some point. And as soon as the heat stroke starts to happen, as soon as your body no longer can cool itself through its normal mechanisms, your body temperature rises rapidly. And in most serious heat-related illnesses, according to the CDC, when heat stroke happens, your body temperature can go up to 106 degrees in 10 to 15 minutes from a normal temperature. That's a short amount of time. If you really think about it, 10 to 15 minutes, you know, you're not out there sweating away, digging a ditch or whatever. You could just walk, like Kara, walking from your car might take you 10 minutes. And heat stroke can hit you in if it's hot enough. It can cause permanent disability or, you know, it can kill you just like that. And if people are suffering from heat stroke, this isn't like just bring them in and give them a cold compress and give them some water. Like this is like take them to the hospital. You know, you should do those things too while you're taking them to the hospital.
Yeah, your cells can't function basically. It's just like you start to get multi organ failure.
And proteins denature, like all sorts of stuff happens. That's not good.
So, you know, rule of thumb here is we live in a world now where people need to be looking at the heat index. Now, I was also interested in the idea of how much of the population is going to be affected by extreme heat. And I wanted to know, like, from a global perspective. So a study that I found was published in the journal Nature Sustainability, and they assessed the impact of global warming on world population. And they calculated that population growth and the expected global warming that you know, basically the amount of temperature, the way that the temperature is going to go up and how consistent that temperature is going to be, they concluded that by 2030, approximately 2 billion people will no longer be living in a location that temperature-wise is considered safe. Yeah, like 2 billion people can't move somewhere else. There's nowhere for 2 billion people to go to. The rest of the world can't absorb 2 billion people, right? Like this means that our world culture is going to change. It has to change.
It also means a lot of people are going to die.
Oh my God, Kara, it's frightening to think. You know, like I'm talking a lot about the United States because I was not finding it hard to find studies. You know, there's lots of studies that were going on about the temperatures this summer and everything. You know, so roughly about 600 people died this summer from heat stroke. And I read an article and they're like, you know, those numbers are going to skyrocket. Like people are going to be dying of straight up heat stroke left and right. You know, as these temperatures go up, right? You know, like here we are in 2023 and the temperatures that we had in the United States were in the extreme zone, like basically. So at 125 degrees Fahrenheit or 51 degrees Celsius or higher, you know, it's a heat stroke. That's basically the only thing that's going to happen to you at that point is you're just going to get hit with heat stroke. And these temperatures were common this summer already. And here we are in 2023 and they're saying by 2030, which is, you know, less than 7 years away at this point, you know, 2 billion people are going to be dealing with that, with extreme danger, heat.
It's not just people. And that's the thing that we, you know, we focus on that, right? Because that's us.
Yeah.
But like, I don't know if you guys were covering or were following what's been going on in the water temperature in Florida.
Oh, yeah.
It was over 100 degrees.
Yeah. Yes. I heard that. That's nuts.
And I mean, we're seeing statements coming out from, you know, different management experts here. The Coral Restoration Foundation, 100% coral mortality at multiple reefs off of the Florida Keys.
Yeah, a researcher said it was so depressing because I had to read a lot of, like, you know, information that wasn't just about people because they were talking about insect populations and you know, cattle and all this stuff. And they said 100%, if we go above 1.5, there are no more coral reefs and they're gone. And that's it.
And they're already dying. Like, we're seeing it in a tiny example of it right now in the Florida Keys. They're bleaching out completely and just going.
And
because they can't sustain these water temperatures.
Once they go, I mean, I would like to know if they could even ever come back. You know, it's like once they're gone, are they gone forever? Or is there still like...
Right. Are they extinct? Yeah. Or can we bring them back from farmed coral? I don't know.
Banked enough of it to bring it back in the future.
Or would there be anywhere to bring it back to?
Well, right. It would have to have the conditions correct again to reintroduce it.
You know, I didn't want to end on a horrible note, right? So I'm like, let me try to squeeze something positive out of this. So here it is. It is possible that we, as a global community, in governments around the world, we could limit this to 1.5, right? 1.5, they say it's bad, but it's not horrible. And it's completely livable and we're going to be fine if we hit the brakes and we don't let it go above 1.5. But when we start getting to 1.7, 1.8, 1.9 and 2, that's when things could get very bad. So what we need to do, you know, again, I say this all the time. What can I do? I'm some guy sitting in, you know, my office right now. You know, what the hell can I do about global warming? You know, you start with voting. You know, you start with, you know, whatever effect you can have on local politics. Do it. Get out and vote and put the right people in that are going to focus on this. Because we can do it, guys. We could still do it. It's not too late.
It's almost too late. If you look at all the projections, like all the – oh, here's like the 300 pathways forward. If we vary all of these variables, there's like out of hundreds of ways forward, there's like four of them that keep warming below 1.5, literally four.
Oh, great.
And that's better than Dr. Strange. You only found one.
And that's where we
millions.
Do everything right. Yeah, that's where we do absolutely everything at the maximally best end of the spectrum. It's
unlikely.
Not going to happen.
Frustrating is that we have the toolkit to do that. We're just choosing not to.
We're choosing
like,
not to.
It's not like a passive thing. We're like, ooh, if we just like keep it. It's like, no, we just got to do it.
100%. 100%. We know what to do. We have the technology to do it. Mm-hmm. This is purely a function of political will.
Yep.
We do not have the collective political will to do everything that we have to do.
That's why I don't want to sound dramatic right now. But everybody that listens to this podcast right now, we need to talk to other people and educate people and get them to vote and get them to talk to other people and have this, you know, be you tell 10 people and they tell 10 people. Like we have to. It is up to us. It really is, because we in most places around the world, we vote people in to political positions of power. And I know that that's a super oversimplification.
No, but it's true. Those are the places where our will has to be flexed, because in the places where we don't vote people in, they can just snap their fingers and make these changes.
Yeah.
Whether they do or they don't is, you know, going to be it's left to be seen. But it's actually in democratic places where we need to be doing this, because these are the places where we can have such political failures, interestingly.
I mean, we could spend the rest of the show talking about this.
Yes, but you're right. So anyway, Steve, I just wanted people to have this information to be careful, because most of us are going to have to deal with extreme heat. So read about it, educate yourself, make sure your friends and family know. And man, I'm telling you, when it's in the danger or extreme danger zone with the heat index, wherever you are, whatever, you know, Fahrenheit or Celsius, figure it out and protect yourself, because it's
good. You need a backup plan if your air conditioning fails.
That's right. That's right.
Mm.
All right, Evan, tell us how things are going with Australian psychics.
You know, it's amazing what comes up in your searches and feeds. I mean, the other day, so, hey, Evan, we want you to read about this brand new news item about a psychic from Australia. Oh, my gosh. They know me so well, I cannot resist those kinds of things. Scary. So, yeah, a television show in Australia called A Current Affair. Remember A Current Affair?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. I remember
late 80s, early 90s in the United States, there was a show called A Current Affair.
Oh, yeah.
And this isn't unlike that. What do we call them? Magazine television shows, TV shows, something like that? Well, in any case, A Current Affair Australia did a piece on a psychic named Cale O'Donnell. He's 27 years old. He's got 1.1 million followers on TikTok. He is self-proclaimed the number one psychic in Australia right now, simply the best, according to, well, himself. Yeah. But
hey,
don't ask me.
No better source than that, right?
Yeah, well, no. How about, you remember Shaman Durek? You know, he of the belief that sadness causes cancer in children. Sad children bring cancer about themselves. Yeah. So he says, Cale is amazing, so powerful and so vibrant. Yeah, that's Shaman Durek. So that's the kind of company that he keeps. But apparently O'Donnell's becoming something of a household name in Australia. He's been on several news shows this summer. And this is why A Current Affair sent an investigative reporter named Martin King to interview him and to watch him perform his gimmick. Here's a summary of his claims. Let me know if this sounds familiar at all to you. He claims to talk to dead people. He claims to talk to plants. He thinks there are spirit guides. He uses a spirit box to get messages in graveyards. We'll get back to the spirit box in a minute. He says that people should not overthink a psychic reading, and you should not put stringent expectations on a reading. Setting limits or expectations on a reading messes up the frequencies of that reading. And he states he has nothing to prove to skeptics. He says, I'm not really in the world to try and prove to skeptics. Instead, he says, my job is to convince the skeptics. I think it's the job of the psychic to convert a skeptic into a believer. Any of that sound familiar?
Oh, just like all the time.
Exactly. Yeah. Every single other self-proclaimed psychic who claims they can communicate with dead people say pretty much the exact same thing. So basically the report consists of Cale and this reporter walking around a graveyard, listening to a device that, you know, looks and sounds like a palm-held transistor radio with an antenna. And they're just walking around, whereas this device is basically making these noises. And he's interpreting what the noises basically are saying and saying that that is dead people communicating. What is the device? It's called a spirit box. The S, specifically the PSB7T model spirit box, a compact tool that is ideal for attempting communication with paranormal entities. This is from the manufacturer, by the way. It uses radio frequency sweeps to generate white noise, which, theory suggests, gives some entities the energy they need to be heard. So while this occurs, you may hear voices or sounds coming through the static. These anomalies may be generated by spirit entities in an attempt to communicate. And according to Cale, you have to train yourself to hearing it. So, yeah, basically what it is a radio. It scans the AM and FM bands, but it jumps. It jumps, like, for a half of a second, it'll remain at one channel, and then it'll jump to the next channel, and then the next one. So it says, blip, 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 right? Constantly changing of channels, and you're getting little blips of sounds, static, noises, the occasional, perhaps, word that comes through. And, you know, ghost hunters, psychics, and others believe that this is a means by which ghosts, entities, spirits, everyone else can communicate with the living world through this device. Oh, and by the way, it has a plus or minus 5-degree hot and cold spot detection feature in there. I checked it out in the specifications. So just,
Evan, you know, 'cause it sounds like It's designed to create anomalies.
that's exactly correct, Jay. Look, you got to have the right tool for the right job, and if you're going to play this role in life, then this is the tool that you have to have. Remember when Perry wanted to invent his nope-o-meter?
Nope-o-meter,
For skeptics, it was a box, and all it said was nope. But you turn the dial, it would go faster if you get near. So nope. Oh my gosh, he cracked me up, the nope-o-meter, right? So this is just good fun, right? No harm, what's the harm? Wrong. O'Donnell, this Kale O'Donnell, he has the nerve to charge people $800 per hour for his services. And he claims to have a 2.5-year waiting list of people wanting these services. So what that means, if we put a conservative estimate on it of 4 hours per week, and that's, I think that's a conservative estimate, that would be at $800, $3,200 per week, 52 weeks a year. I'll call it 50 weeks a year, give him 2 weeks off, times 2.5 years. That's about $400,000 that people are willing to pay him, or roughly $160,000. Per year. Now, either he's lying about the number of people who want this shtick, which I would not be surprised about, or he's really getting it, which is a sad reality indeed, that this person is making bank off of this. He guarantees in that hour of work, he will make contact with at least three dead people, minimum of three, and he will record himself talking over the static of this frequency jumping radio dopometer, and give that to you as proof of his work. He says, I connect people with their loved ones. I am basically the postal service person of the spirit world. Yeah, postal service charging $800 for three deliveries. What a bargain. Now, fortunately for A Current Affair, they did the right thing and they contacted the Australian skeptics. And our good friend, none other than Richard Saunders, appeared on the show, and Richard Saunders is, of course, the host of the Skeptics Zone podcast, which we highly recommend to our SGU audience. Richard was given ample time throughout this 8-minute segment. He made all the good salient points. He was not unfairly edited or cut short. And Richard correctly reminded the audience that psychics will use cold reading and, in many cases, hot reading techniques to get the results that their clients desire. Do I need to go into what cold reading and hot reading are? For the audience, do you think?
Give a bullet.
Sure. Cold reading, when a psychic does not have any specific facts about their target, but they'll throw out a bevy of questions and phrases which are so broad that anyone could believe that these loose statements are about the person they're trying to communicate with. It's like a game of 20 questions with the dead, where the person who's paying the psychic will give feedback and reactions to the words and phrases being thrown around by the psychic. It's a powerful illusion that often leaves believers impressed, especially when they've invested their hard-earned money in this reading in the first place. But a hot reading is when a psychic will find actual information and facts and data about, say, that dead person. Nowadays, that happens often by scouring social media pages where loved ones post facts and other things about the people who have passed on. That is out and out fraud, but a psychic might use that to wield great emotional and financial advantage over their victims who are paying for it. Now, Richard informs us in the A Current Affair section that what Kale is doing as far as the meter and the device is going is that it's audio pareidolia, basically. He's going around, he's hearing the static, this jumping around of frequencies, and then he's basically telling the person what he thinks he's hearing and therefore bang, some kind of communication. Audio pareidolia, we've talked about it many times on the show before. Saunders and the Australian Skeptics, they're urging O'Donnell to take up their challenge, offering a big cash reward, $100,000, if he can prove he has psychic powers. Come on, test it, and the money is yours. That's what Richard told A Current Affair. And so far, they've not heard back from him. I communicated with Richard about this last night, and not a peep. Although Kale, in the interview that he did with A Current Affair, when this was brought up about the $100,000 challenge that the Australian skeptics have, is that, he'd never heard of it before. How real could it possibly be if he somehow was never brought to his attention? I'll end on this. According to an organization called ScamWatch, last year Australians were robbed of a reported $260,000 from psychic-related scams, which is an increase of 219% compared to the previous year. So these things are on the rise, up, up, up. Social media, TikTok, all these things no doubt having an impact on it. But that number is conservative because a lot of victims of these scams don't report these incidents out of embarrassment. Beware the psychics always.
All right. Thanks, Evan.
Yep.
All right, Kara, tell us how good people are at detecting speech deepfakes.
Well, according to the authors of a new study, not great. Let's see. A few takeaways here, but first I want to introduce the study. It was just recently published in PLOS One, which means that it is open access, the Public Library of Science. Study was published by 4 researchers from University College London in the Department of Security and Crime Science and the Department of Computer Science. And the title is Warning: Humans Cannot Reliably Detect Speech Deepfakes. A little bit of a spoiler alert on the title there. And actually, the numbers, I think, when you look at them alone, are a little bit misleading because they found that listeners correctly spot deepfakes 73% of the time. That sounds like not bad, mm-hmm. but yeah. It's also not that different from how often they correctly spot real speech. So that starts to become problematic. And they break down the data in a lot of really interesting ways. So they basically ran a study where they looked at about 500 people, plus or minus 529 was their N. And they presented genuine and deepfake audio. And they talk a lot in the study about how they, you know, produced the deepfake audio. They did, the bona fide stimuli and the deepfake stimuli, both in English and Mandarin, because they wanted to see if there were any, like, differences in detection capabilities of different language speakers. And then they presented them in interesting ways. So they did a unary presentation where they took 20 randomly chosen clips and they presented them to people separately, like separate screens or separate pages, I guess you could say. They listened to about an equal number of bona fide and synthesized clips, but they didn't know what the proportion was going to be. And so they just were tasked with deciding whether they were real or fake. And then they did a binary presentation where they presented, again, 20 randomly chosen, but this time they were pairs, not clips. And they had them choose which one's the real and which one's the fake, which was kind of similar to how you did this with us the other day, right, Jay?
Oh, yeah.
So yours was more like a binary presentation where it was a choice. Is it this one or that one? Whereas the unary was like there was no context. It was like just let us know if it's real or fake, and you have no idea how many of each there are. And then they did something called a familiarization treatment where they took half of the participants, randomly assigning them to basically familiarization. So they told the participants that there were the synthesized examples, that let them listen to the synthesized examples multiple times. They were separate from the ones that they were using in the main task, but they were of the same ilk, and allowed them basically to, quote, train on listening to deepfakes. And so let's talk a little bit about the results because they're pretty interesting. Ultimately, their takeaways were that overall, people are not great at this, just like individual people. They do make the correct classifications 70.35% of the time in the unary scenario, so classifying whether it was real or fake. They were actually better at identifying deepfakes than at identifying bona fide things, which is interesting. They only identified the bona fides about 68% of the time and the deepfakes 73% of the time. The researchers actually think that the reason for that is because people were like primed, and so now they had increased skepticism. They were like, oh, there's going to be a deepfake. So there were like false, you know, positives there. And then when they gave the binary scenario, there was a little bit of better performance. They were able to correctly recognize the deepfakes in 85% of the trials, but this is not realistic in the real world, because in the real world, when you're presented with a deepfake, you're not going to be asked if it's real or fake, and you're not going to have another version of it next to it, which is the alternative. So even if this is a better scenario, the researchers said, you know, this isn't realistic. People aren't going to actually ever be approaching the question of whether this is fake in the real world this way. So then let's talk a little bit about the interventions, right? So the training. They found that when there is a reference audio, it does help with deepfake detection. So when there's more context, it is easier to hear synthesized speech. But when they trained humans on deepfakes, it didn't really improve their accuracy that much. It increased their detection accuracy, they said, by 4% on average.
Yeah, that's negligible.
Yeah. So the familiarizations, they said it equates to an accuracy that's only slightly above chance, 52.31%.
So that's basically where we're at already.
They said it's equally difficult to tell the difference between real speech and synthesized speech in Mandarin and English. Even like so, they said that. Well, they said shorter deepfakes were deepfakes are not easier to identify, but I wouldn't have hypothesized that they are. They also found that listening to the clips more frequently did not aid in detection, and spending more time on the task did not affect performance at all. And you really don't get better unless you get explicit feedback. So just listening over and over, you don't improve your ability to detect. You have to actually hear explicit feedback. You're correct, you're incorrect, you're correct, you're incorrect. It's the only way. So basically the researcher's big takeaway was we shouldn't be putting too much effort into training people to do this because people aren't probably going to be able to learn how to do this well. We need to be putting effort into training automated detectors. They did say, though, as kind of a secondary check, that crowd speech detection is comparable to the top performing automated detectors right now. So there is strength in numbers, interestingly. Individuals aren't very good at this, but crowds working together can do a good job of differentiating between the two. And so I think there will be some really interesting research now on the horizon of why that is and what exactly they're tapping into.
But my response to that is, isn't it just a matter of time? I mean, you know, in 3 years...
Yeah, it's going to be so much better than even the ones that they used here.
Yeah, like it will get to the point very, very, very soon where you can't tell the difference.
And they even said, like, ours aren't that good. Like, in this study, they were pretty crude and people still sucked at it. So, like, it's not going to be good in the future.
We're going to need AI to help detect
the AI,
what is fake and what is not.
Absolutely.
That's the outcome of this study.
We'll all have our AI shields.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't like it.
Is it going to be that kind of rat race of like, you know, we've talked about this before, Steve. I know it's like a weird analogy that I'm coming to in my head, but like designer drugs. It's like there's new designer drugs, so we have to come up with new designer drug tests. And then there's new designer drugs that get out of the way of the drug tests. And it's just this constant chase.
Yeah.
So it's like the deepfakes get better, the detectors have to get better. And then the deepfakes are going to try and outfake the detectors. And, you know, we're constantly going to be catching up with our own tail.
That's all right, Jay. Eventually, we'll just, you know, have a deep fake voice of you do all of your online activity.
Sure, and it'll probably, so Steve,
just be
it'll
fake
probably
Jay.
Be better than me.
All right.
It'll be better.
Thanks, fake Kara. All right.
You're welcome.
Wow, that was impressive.
You never know. You never know.
Never,
yeah,
never
how
know.
Are you going to prove it? You only have a 4% difference chance.
All right. I'm going to test how much you guys know about electric vehicles.
Okay, I'm ready.
I've been, I know two one, things about them.
I've been writing a lot about it. I've been doing TikTok videos about it. My God, people on TikTok are out there.
Yep.
The comments are just like, this is an alternate reality that people are living in here. Anyway, there are some common themes. A lot of questions come up when I write about it. I get the comments. There's a few comments that happen over and over again, so I thought I should review it. And I've deepened my knowledge about it in answering these questions. Because some things come up like you wouldn't anticipate. All right, so what do people say who push back against the notion that there are some advantages to electric vehicles?
Like, what do they say?
What do they say? What are people's fears and complaints? And what is the narrative, the anti-electric vehicle narrative? That's
I have a few
there?
Answers for that.
Expensive.
One of them is that the electricity is being generated by fuel.
Yeah,
that's
so
a big one.
So one comment is that electric vehicles don't work because the electricity is being produced largely by fossil fuel. So the answer to that is even if you're charging your car from electricity that's produced by 100% fossil fuel, it's still better than burning gasoline. The electric vehicle is more efficient. You get more miles per carbon, you know, that gets put in the air to make the energy. Basically, they're about twice as efficient as an internal combustion engine.
Mm-hmm.
There's also the fact that, you know, because of the range issue, electric vehicles tend to be more aerodynamic.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the idea is that while we, like, over the next 20 to 30 years, which is how long it's going to take to fully transition our car fleet from internal combustion to electric, right? that over that same period of time, we're going to be decarbonizing our electricity grid, right? So like these, like we can't wait until we're 100% renewable and then say, okay, now let's get rid of our gasoline burning cars. It's like, all right, it's going to take another 30 years to do that. These good things have to be done at the same time.
Yeah, of course.
So that's a that's a nonsensical response, and it's also not true because just the efficiency of the EVs make them better, even if the energy mix isn't great. Evan said something for Evan threw out cost. They're expensive.
Cost. They are too expensive, Steve.
But they're not.
They are.
Evan.
No.
I know. I hear you.
But my hybrid truck costs less than the gas version of the same truck.
And you know what? It's a hybrid.
That's amazing.
It's a hybrid. I know. Yeah.
And all right. So the upfront cost of electric vehicles is more expensive, like 20% or so. Although that price is coming down. We're just getting over a price spike for EVs because demand soared and supply was hampered by all the supply issues that everybody was having during the pandemic. There were no chips, et cetera. So supply and demand, you know, the prices spiked, but they're now settling down and they're actually really coming into parity with ICE vehicles. But here's the thing. If you look at the cost to own the car over the lifetime of the car, electric vehicles are significantly less expensive for several reasons. One, it's cheaper per mile, right? It's just cheaper to drive them. You pay less for the electricity in, you know, per mile than you pay for the gasoline that you got to burn per mile. Two, there's almost no maintenance.
No oil changes.
Yeah, no oil changes. There's very few moving parts. The brakes last a lot longer because of regenerative braking. You know, there's just no maintenance. You know, they're very, very low maintenance vehicles.
By the way, cars are just more expensive now than they ever have been before. Yeah. Like, I think we sometimes forget that because it's like we're comparing them to how expensive cars used to be.
Yeah.
But just owning, like, I think the average cost of a new car is like over $35,000.
Yeah, they are getting because partly because we like our big cars, but and the other thing is if you finance your car, like if you finance your car over 6 years, which most people do, right? Most people don't plunk down cash for a car, you put down a deposit or you do a trade in and you finance the rest. It's a 4, 5, 6 year finance. If you finance it over 5 or 6 years, over that period of time, you know, you will have made back the extra money it cost you for the more expensive vehicle in lower maintenance and operating costs. So if you have to look at what's this going to cost me per month over 5 years, not just what's the upfront sticker shock, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And they're actually cost effective. You save money at the lifetime of the car. All right, the insurance is a little higher on electric vehicles. And the reason for that is because of uncertainty. It's because the insurance companies don't have decades of actuary tables, you know, so they just don't know what the real risk is. And so they basically charge for that unknown by higher rates. But as we get more electric vehicles on the road and there's more history, the uncertainty is going away and the prices are coming into parity with gasoline cars. But even if you include that, you include everything, they're still cheaper. And here's the one big thing. Guess what the average life expectancy of an internal combustion engine car is in miles?
Miles? 150?
120.
I'd say 200.
200, Jay. Jay's correct. Wow. It's 200.
200? Really?
What's 200. What's the expected life expectancy of an all-electric vehicle?
300?
It's 300.
Oh.
300.
300. 300. Yeah, so 50% more. The car's going to last you 50. And I think that's a conservative estimate. 300,000 miles. That's 50% longer. So, right? You have to amortize the cost over time. So the electric vehicles are much more cost effective, much more if you include that factor. It's like the LED bulbs. Yeah, they cost a lot more. Like, oh my God, I'm going to pay $20 on one bulb.
Oh, I love my LED bulbs.
But then they're
good, because now that's all you're allowed to buy.
I know. Cost effective. Yeah, that's a great thing.
They are. They're wonderful. Oh my, I used to be in a constant state of changing light bulbs, and I hated it. When you own a house with 40 light bulbs, I can't remember the last time I changed a light bulb.
No, I can't either.
But they are cost effective if you count it over the lifetime of them, just like with the electric vehicles. So cost is really favors electric vehicles. What else you got?
Okay, how about this one? And this one, I'm, you know, a little close to home, but I seem to remember some people on this very show, like 10 years ago. I don't know when I started recording, 7 years ago.
2015.
Having a lot of range anxiety.
Yeah. Range anxiety is the number one reason people cite for why they're anxious about electric vehicles. We've discussed this on this show before. I'm going to just very quickly summarize it. That it's range anxiety is really irrational, and for a couple of reasons. Now, first of all, I have to say that everyone's different. So your experience will depend on your driving habits. If you're somebody who says, oh, I need to drive 300 or 400 miles every day for my job, okay, don't get an electric car. That's not for you. Get a hybrid.
Although, interestingly, you know what's funny is that some of the first electric cars in use were trucks.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, clearly there's a little bit even of a disconnect there, because individuals within these industries knew that electricity was going to be beneficial for buses and like long range trucks. Mm-hmm. You just have to be able to charge.
Yes. So, there's a lot of figures here. The average distance people drive per day is about 30 miles. You could also look at it. You know, averages are not a great way to look at it. Better way to look at it is, on 95% of days, people will be driving less than 40 miles, right? So, and if you go to 100 miles, you're like over 99%, right? Mm-hmm. So it's very rare that somebody is going to need more than about 100 to 150 miles range on the car. But again, people still say, well, what about that one or two trips a year that I take that's long distance? You know, you have to recharge all the time. And I got to tell you, like, I've owned an electric vehicle now for a long time. We take all of our long trips with it, and it's really nothing. I mean, I know this depends on where you live too, but, you know, just like you're going to fill up your tank on a long trip, you're going to fill it. You're going to recharge your car.
Yeah, it's the exact same. It's like almost the same intervals too.
Yeah,
it's
very similar.
It's very similar.
Yeah, it's very similar. And in fact, it's easier. I actually find it takes less time. Because on a long trip,
it smell bad.
What?
It takes a lot. I'll tell you why. Because the car tells you where to stop. Like, it plans the trip for you. Say, I'm going here. It's like, okay, you're going to stop at this charging station, and this will get you to this distance, right? It plans it out for you. It also, you should do that because it prepares your battery, right? It conditions the battery, prepares it for the charge, and then it charges faster. You get a faster fast charge when you do that. And it takes like 10 minutes, 15 minutes to throw an extra 200 or 250 miles into your battery. And that's like a bathroom break. If you're going to stop for lunch, no problem.
What are you talking about?
I'm telling you,
he's talking about fast. He's talking about fast charging.
15 minutes for over 200 miles, I call bullshit.
No, that's correct.
Yeah, he's not talking about standard 240 charging. He's talking about DC fast charging.
Fast charging. I'm talking about fast charging.
The fast charging. But you're not supposed to fast charge all the time and mess with that battery.
It wears down the battery.
Who's talking about all the time?
He's not talking about all the time. He's talking about long road trips. You're plugging it in your garage.
He said 1% of your trips are going to be that long road trip.
So maybe it's three times a year. Yeah, in fact, when they consider fast charging quote-unquote frequently, that's like every week, you know, you're doing it, or three times or four times a month, as opposed to if you're doing it just a few times a year. Even if you do it once a month, that's not even considered a lot. That's not considered frequent. That's considered, you know, just occasional or rare, and it's no problem. And if you look at the lifetime of the battery, it's another issue. Batteries can have to replace your battery. Battery lifespans are in the 300,000 to 500,000 mile range. And so, right, so if the car's going to last for 300,000 miles, the battery's going to last for 300,000 to 500,000 miles, you're never going to have to change your battery, right? Mm-hmm. You can kill your battery if you don't treat it well, but it's not a big deal. All it means is don't let your battery go completely empty and sit empty. That's really all you need to do.
Yeah, it's like keep enough oil in your engine.
Right, it's like saying don't let your engine overheat because you can fry your engine. Has anyone here ever fried your engine in a nice vehicle?
No.
I have once in my life.
One time.
Yeah. So yeah, but which is happens. One more time than I've ever bricked a car battery. But you know, it's not the same amount of time. But anyway, the risk is very low if you just do basic, you know. And again, this cars are so easy to take care of. Just do basic battery hygiene, and if you plug your car in every night, which you're going to do anyway. Another objection people have, unless you guys want to throw out some more.
More objections. The minerals to make the batteries is very harmful to the environment.
That is actually the one legitimate complaint about electric vehicles, is that we still are sourcing cobalt from Democratic Republic of Congo. Is that right? DRC?
DRC.
And it's horrible, you know, slave labor. And it's a problem. And we allowed China to dominate the cobalt industry. So now it's China and the DRC, and we're basically beholden to them.
Yikes.
So it's a problem. I admit that. But, you know, what we need to do is exert political pressure to improve the quality of the lives of people who are mining cobalt in the DRC. But more importantly, we need to design batteries that don't use cobalt. And
right. They
already exist. They already exist, and they're already being – the industry's already switching over. So this is a very temporary problem that will be going away within the next few years.
Really? We'll have a cobalt-free battery existence?
Yep. Ooh. Yep. It's going to be the lithium – it's going to be the lithium-sulfur batteries, which don't use cobalt. And also, you know, the Amprius and those companies that are doing the lithium silicon anode batteries are working on also getting rid of the nickel and cobalt.
Right.
Yeah.
We had someone on to talk about that.
So yes, I admit that is a problem. It's a temporary problem. It's not a deal killer, in my opinion. And you also have to think that if we don't evolve this industry and switch over to, you know, cars that don't burn gasoline, the people who are going to pay for it the most are the very people that you're trying to protect, right? By not buying batteries, if that's your thing.
I wish they could incorporate a solar component to it, like get a little bit of the juice from the sun.
You can.
There are cars that do that, but it is a little bit.
I get that. I mean, you're not going to power the whole thing. Right.
You can, but like, I mean, my little like off-roader rig, I plan to put some solar panels on the top to power anything that I don't want to use my car battery for. You know what I mean? Because I'm going to be sort of living.
Just put solar panels on your roof and charge your car at home.
That's what I'm going to do. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Anybody could do that.
Well, anybody who owns a house. Now, I guess how many people...
No, but I mean even on your car.
Oh, like, yes.
You could do that with your car, too.
You can.
Yeah.
How many people own their own parking space that has access to an outlet? What percentage of people?
Okay.
That's hard to say because so many people rent.
This is the U.S.
have parking.
This is the U.S.
50%?
40.
Yeah, it's, 60? It's 45%.
Wow.
But there's another 30% that own their own parking space, but there isn't already an outlet there. That's easily solvable. You just put in a charger there, right?
Yeah.
So
eventually that's going to change. As more people have them, houses are just going to – like my house has one. I don't even have an electric car anymore.
Yeah.
But, you know, my renters are using it.
So in other words, there's a lot of people – it's 48%, not 45, 48%. But there's a lot of people already have access to a way to plug in their own car. Another 30% potentially do just by, you know, installing an outlet there or putting electricity to it. And, you know, the rest of everyone else, it is more difficult if you don't own your own parking space. But with a lot of chargers at work, chargers at grocery stores – that last 10, 15, 20% of people, there will be solutions. So, but again, we're not talking about everyone buying a car now, right? We're talking about this is going to be phased in over time, certainly pick the low-hanging fruit. I didn't really finish the discussion on range anxiety because that really is a big issue. So there have been studies which show that a car with 250 miles range is more than most people need. It's fine. If you go to, and the average range of electric vehicles being sold in the U.S. right now is approaching 300 miles. So that seems to be where things are settling into around the 300-mile range, which is fine.
It's great. You can't get more than that in a gas car. Like, that's the thing. You're still filling up that often.
Yeah, right. and again, like the recharge thing is not that big a deal. Having done it many, many times now, it's literally a non-issue.
What about battery fires?
So battery fires. Thank you, Bob. That's a good one. So let me ask you a question. What has a higher risk of catching fire? A hybrid car, a gasoline car, or an electric vehicle?
A hybrid car.
Why do
I
you
bet
think
gasoline
you say
car.
That?
I read it somewhere.
Okay, so yeah, you're correct. So per 100,000 sales, the risk of a hybrid vehicle catching fire is 3,474. So that's about 3.4%.
Shit.
For gasoline cars, it's only 3%. It's 1,529. Yeah, so for gasoline cars, it's 1.5%. And for electric vehicles, 25%. It's 0.025%.
Yeah, that's
great. It's just it got all the attention when Tesla was new.
Fires are awful, right?
They're worse when they happen. Yeah, they're much terrible. Worse when they happen because they're harder to put out. But the risk is teeny tiny, and it's much less And, you know, it's almost an or it's a, it, more than an order of magnitude less than a gasoline car. It really is such a rare thing. I mean, again, it's not that it's not a problem, but it's a 0.025% risk. It's not a big deal if you're buying a car. I mean, there's a lot of other higher risks.
It shouldn't give you anxiety.
It shouldn't keep you from buying an electric vehicle. But the other thing is that as batteries get better, that risk is only getting lower. They're already, in fact, designing batteries that are encased in a substance that turns into foam when it heats and it puts the fire out. Right?
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it keeps the battery from basically continuing to burn. Yeah, so that's a problem that is actually actively being solved by advances in battery technology. And we talked to the Amprius guy, like their fire risk is even lower, you know, than existing batteries. So it's tiny and getting smaller. So basically a non-issue. All right, there's a lot more to talk about. I'm going to talk about one more thing. And this has come up quite a bit. And I kind of brushed it aside, but then people kept bringing it up. And in fact, you know, I did a response to a TikTok video where a guy spent a whole video talking about this. So let me ask you this question. When I'm dispelling a lot of myths about electric vehicles and saying that they're a good option and why they're good for the environment, one of the responses was that, again, okay, I had this from multiple people, that we shouldn't be, you know, trying to fix this problem by selling people new cars. We need to fix the problem by getting people to drive less. Through mass transit and other means.
Well, can't it be both?
Exactly. My response has always been, yeah, we'll do both. Why? I mean, it makes absolutely no sense to frame this as an either or. Mm-hmm. It's right. We can walk and chew gum at the same time. And every time I'm like, yeah, that's great. We should build mass transit. We should make cities and towns more walkable because we've basically built our civilization around the personal car. I get that. You know, for most of us, you know, on the show, it would be impossible not to own a car. I could not exist without a personal car. I would be shut in at home. I don't.
Right. Connecticut's not the state.
It's not the state. Yeah. It's sprawling suburbs without mass transit. Like I couldn't get anywhere, even in good weather, let alone in a snowstorm and rain and all that stuff. So anyway, just their cars aren't going anywhere anytime soon. Yes, we can do a multi-generational program of slowly, you know, reversing this 100-year trend, you know, of building our infrastructure with the idea that most people own their own car, to make it easier not to own a car, or to make it so that people have to drive less, that they have more walkable options, more bikeable options, more mass transit options. Absolutely. But there's still going to be billions of cars on the planet for the foreseeable future. And the question is, should those cars be electric vehicles or burn gasoline? We could say, should they be hybrid? Should they be hydrogen? We could, you know, compare all of those things. I'm just focusing on electric vehicles today, right? Isn't that like a non sequitur? You know, like it makes no sense to say that we shouldn't be advocating for electric vehicles, or we should be advocating for no vehicles. No, we should be doing both.
There's also no such thing as no vehicles. We're always going to need buses and trains, and those should be electric also.
Yeah, right.
So it's like, you know.
Yeah, no, it's part. Like, that's the other thing is that, yeah, we're just trading one type of vehicle for another. But
yeah, and the future of mass transit, the future of driverless cars where you just kind of rent one, sort of like Uber, but there's no driver. Like, all this is great because it's true. It does get fewer cars off the road, which is another brilliant goal, but it's not either or.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, you can't, I don't know. All these roads lead to improvement.
It's amazing how I had a really hard time convincing people that that was like a logical fallacy. That we should.
I think
just
it's
do
hard
both.
Because so many people already don't drive.
Yes,
and it's sort of like,
and they all don't drive. All the people who are stuck in it, they don't. They don't. Yeah. They live in a city, and they don't get it. It's like, no, my life is impossible without a car.
Yeah,
I do think that was part of the difference in perspective.
And even if your life wasn't, the change would be so severe and significant. It's just, again, it's a difficulty like taking somebody else's frame. But I think it does work both ways too, because we see this a lot with our, you know, vegan and vegetarian friends too, who are like, how can you possibly eat meat? And it's like, that's, I think, valid, and there are valid and interesting arguments there, but, you know, people aren't monolithic.
Yeah.
And just because you have managed to do it and you don't see it as being a huge threat to your lifestyle, you, like, try to empathize with people who can't or won't.
Yeah.
And vice versa. We need to try to empathize with people who can and do and go, like, what can I learn from them?
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, to me, it's like let a thousand flowers bloom, right? It's all good. And but the idea that, like, we don't need to be advocating for electric vehicles is nonsensical. I don't see how you get there.
Yeah, if there's no emissions, there's no emissions, and that's awesome, and that's what we want. Yeah.
I'm looking forward to electric planes.
Electric
someday.
Planes too. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that will be big.
Yeah.
And I have to say, and interestingly, somebody got really offended the last time I said this, which is like a weird thing to get offended about, in my opinion. But electric vehicles are really fun to drive. So for a couple of reasons,
so fun.
Yeah, first, the pickup is tremendous.
It's nuts.
Absolutely tremendous. There's none of that. And now I kind of get frustrated when I drive. Our other car is still gasoline. I haven't replaced it yet. And you hit the gas and it's like there's nothing there for a half a second. It's like, oh, come on. But here's the other thing is that electric vehicles are weighted better. Their weight distribution is much better because most of the weight is in the battery, which is on the bottom and evenly distributed. Whereas with a gasoline car, the engine is higher up and in the front.
Yeah.
And so the electric cars handle better. They're just better cars, in my
And of
opinion.
Course, I just said there's no torque, but I meant there's maximum torque.
Yeah, yeah.
Meaning that, like, they instantly accelerate because they don't
get into the gears. They instantly accelerate, yeah.
They instantly, like, off the line, electric cars beat the most intense performance cars. Mm-hmm. They might not be able to sustain that. It depends on the level of the electric car. But off the line, their torque is, like, equivalent to or better than, like, Porsches and Ferraris and Lamborghinis. Like, it's incredible. They're so fun to drive.
Yeah, yeah. But here's one downside to that is that people do like to accelerate with them, and they wear out their tires faster.
Yeah. I think they'll get over it soon.
We'll get over it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And also the thing is, don't get more range than you need, because then you're dragging around a bigger battery than you need. Don't treat your range anxiety by just getting a massive battery. It's heavy. It's expensive. It uses up limited resources. You know, really think about what you need and what your driving is, and get the size battery that you need.
You could say the same about the actual dimensions of your car.
Yeah, that's true too.
Like, you know, I feel like a lot of people need to hear that advice. Like,
yeah,
well,
absolutely.
Can you, Steve? You said that 95 or 99% of your driving is like 100 miles or less.
Yeah,
or fewer. Now, could you get a car with a 150-mile range? Probably not at this point.
It's getting hard to get anything less than 200 to 250. They're still out there.
But just don't get the extended version. Like, it's getting to the point now where you can buy different versions of an electric car.
Yeah, right. Most of the models have, like, the basic version and the extended range version. And just you know, personalize it to your driving needs. Some people – I take a lot of long trips. It's not, like, once or twice a year. So, like, I actually – did really appreciate the, you know, like, the 300-mile range. But if you're somebody who, like, you're really just commuting 30 or 40 miles and you rarely take long trips, don't get a massive battery. It's not necessary. It's inefficient.
Even that commute, did you say that was the average?
So average is, like,
seems high.
Less than 40 miles, like 30 miles. But
yeah, because, like,
less than 95% is like 40 miles, which is a better way to look at it, I think. All right, let's move on. Bob, you're going to give us a quickie.
Oh.
Ah.
Hey.
I'm ready.
Get your mind out of the gutter.
BG.
Thank you, Steve. This is your quickie with Bob. Big whales make big news this week. It turns out the biggest creature to ever exist on the Earth may not be the big and beautiful blue whale that we all know and love. Recent fossil evidence points to a new potential winner of the coveted most Brobdingnagian life form ever.
Oh,
and it's
Meg.
Called Perusitis colossus. I love that name. Perusitis colossus. This whale lived over 39 million years ago. Its 18 fossil bones were discovered back in 2010. So it took 13 years to really get some solid, detailed information, but we finally got it, and it shows that they could have weighed almost twice as much or more than a blue whale. Twice, wow. But remember, I said could have, because the official range now is between 85 and 320 tons for this new beast.
That's a big range.
It's a huge range, but apparently there's lots of assumptions made on, like, the weight of organs and blubber and all sorts of stuff. So there are a lot of assumptions there, but it could have been as heavy as 320 tons. Now, big whales get as heavy as 190 tons, so this potentially could be way, way beyond them. So now we can't definitively say it was heavier, right? We have, like, basically one data point. for this new Colossus whale. But we can say that the Colossus has the heaviest skeleton ever. That's pretty much definitive. The heaviest skeleton we've ever encountered. That's because the normally spongy interior of bones, I mean, your bones are not bone solid all the way through. It's like a spongy material on the inside. But not for these guys. They had deposits filling those pores, making it their bones much, much heavier. The researchers even described them as swollen. When they looked at the bones, they thought they were rocks, and they thought they were, you know, when they realized they were bones, they looked swollen to them. Just not even a blue whale's bones. They're big, but they're kind of sleek, they described them as. These bones just seem like they're inflated. Regardless, though, the blue whale is still the longest ever that we know of, over 33 meters, 108 feet. Perusetus colossus was only 20 meters or 66 feet. So definitely not as long, but possibly heavier. So maybe we'll find more and more complete specimens in the future to be sure that Perusetus colossus really deserves its name. So we shall see. Back to you, Steve.
Yeah, so just a couple other things.
Just a couple.
Before this specimen, the thinking was, the evidence suggested age of gigantism among whales would happen 4 to 4.5 million years ago. This guy's 30 million years old. So
that's a big push back.
It pushes it back. But the thing is, this could be just one branch. You know what I mean? It doesn't necessarily mean that there have been these giant whales for the last 30 million years. We don't know. It's one specimen.
Yeah.
But it is also lovely to see, especially since I lived through the era when creationists were saying there's no transitional whales, to like just explosion of whale ancestor fossils and just this amazing branching bush of whale evolution. This is just one more twig, one more branch.
One more fascinating, big, heavy twig.
Absolutely. All right, thanks, Bob. Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys, last week I played this noisy.
Ooh. That wheel needs some oil.
I got a lot of people that wrote in, and a lot of people got it correct. Which
I know exactly what that is.
I think you would. So the first person is a listener named Elliot, and Elliot wrote in, "Hello, my name is Elliot, longtime listener, first time guessing. Osprey. I grew up on a lake in Colorado mountains, and we had several osprey nests within earshot of the house."
Not a bad guess.
Not a bad guess, but not correct. Thank you for that. Jim Kelly wrote in, "Howdy from Texas, where people vacation in hell in order to cool off." My guess for this week's noisy is that it's a squeaky wheel turning, such as on a cart or some kind of mechanical device, such as a wheel and pulley system, etc. Boy, does that sound like a squeaky wheel. But Jim, it's not a squeaky wheel. Let's keep going. Next one from a listener named Daniel. "Hi, Jay. This week's noisy sounds to me like birds chirping in a rainforest." Yeah, I know. Unimaginative and probably wrong, but that's what my ears say. Daniel, not bad. You're heading in the right direction. I had tons of listeners. The person that won basically wrote "eagle, nuff said." That's all they wrote. That was Craig Bleel, whatever. I'm sorry about your last name. I can't pronounce it. But then I had another listener named Dave Martin write in and give a little more explanation. Said, "Greetings from Seattle, Washington, or Seattle, Jay. I am fairly certain this is the sound of the bald eagle makes. In my late 20s, I worked as a guide and naturalist in Alaska, northern British Columbia, and the Yukon Territory. Mostly, I led hiking and rafting tours. And said one of the rafting tours I would take clients on was a day trip, float down the Chilkat River within the Alaska Chilkat Bald Eagle Preserve, located just outside of Haines, Alaska. So he said the preserve is home to the world's largest concentration of bald eagles. So basically, he is correct. This is a group of bald eagles that are all talking to each other. I think it's likely that these were younger bald eagles, and they're just chittering and chatting away at each other. They sound absolutely nothing like the sound of a bald eagle that you'll hear in any movie or TV show. So real quick, listen again.
You mean the hawk?
the hawk, which is, Bald eagles, everybody.
They're beautiful. I love seeing them.
I remember seeing one for the first time at a bird show on this guy's, you know, arm, and it was so striking, so beautiful, and so large. It's like they can rip your head off. It just seemed so so like intimidating in a way, knowing that if they let loose, they could do some amazing things. But
oh, yeah.
Magnificent, just magnificent. I just wish they didn't sound so lame.
Well, I got a new noisy for you guys this week. This one was sent in by a listener named Lucas Snyder. That's a weird one.
Oh, it's a ghost detector, it sounds like.
Exactly.
Scanning frequencies.
Exactly. You're walking through graveyards, right?
That's right. They're communicating with you, saying, I miss you, I love you.
the money I hid is under the bed.
That's right.
So if you think you know what this week's noisy is, or you heard something cool, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Don't email me anywhere else. Email me there. That'll guarantee that I see it. Mm-hmm. So a few things, Steve. We had a meeting recently about Nauticon, all the people that are running Nauticon, because we wanted to finalize a lot of important details, and I'm going to pass those details on to you. First and foremost, so Nauticon is a conference that's happening on November 3rd and 4th in White Plains, New York, accessible to the New York airports, the Westchester Airport, even Bradley International Airport in Connecticut. So the basic concept of the conference is that during the day, we're going to be doing different events and different bits and things that are there to entertain you. And then you will have plenty of time mixed in throughout the day and the night to socialize with your friends that will also be attending the conference. So here are some things that we'll be doing at Nauticon. Well, first off, on Friday and Saturday night, both of those nights, there'll be nighttime entertainment. We'll be doing a live Boomer versus Zoomer quiz show that we created. George Hobb is the host of that show, and that'll be on Friday night. We'll be picking contestants from the audience. And on Saturday night, Brian Wecht and George Hobb will be doing something called the Insanely 80s Sing-Along. This is a theme sing-along featuring 80s music and some cool stuff. I'm about to drop some cool details on you. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of Trey Magnifique, but this is a special guest that we will be having that will be joining us for the Insanely 80s sing-along themed. If you are fans of Ninja Sex Party, you probably know who this character is. And also, speaking of Ninja Sex Party, there is a character named Ninja Brian.
Yeah.
We have made communication with Ninja Brian, which you cannot do with words. You have to nope. Write things down and send secret messages and whatnot. But what we did get back from Ninja Brian was that Ninja Brian will be doing silent stand-up comedy.
Oh, no.
Yes.
To see what this is.
Yes, he will be doing this at Nauticon. He specifically asked that we did not announce when it will happen. But he will be there. He will be making an appearance, and there will be stand-up comedy happening. And I want to tell you that I've seen Ninja Brian do stand-up comedy in the past, and it is remarkably funny. He's so goddamn good. You gotta go.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it's so good. It's such a treat. So those two characters will be showing up, and then we have a few things that I wanted to tell you about. Let me give you an example of some of the things that are going to happen. We have a thing that we're going to do at Nauticon called How to Blank. Sounds crazy, but what it is that each one of us throughout the course of the 2 days, each one of us, like, you know, so all the people in the SGU, then we got Brian Wecht, we got George Hobb, we got Andrea Jones-Roy. We are going to be teaching you something from one of our skill sets. And we talked in detail about what everybody's going to be doing. I know what everybody's going to be talking about. And I got to tell you that there's a lot of fun and interesting things that are going to happen during this part of the show. We have something called Truth or Dare. This is another yeah. game that we're going to be playing. This is really, again, each of these things, most of the things that we're doing will involve the audience in one way or another. We have another thing that's called the Actor's Nightmare. This is a really heavy audience interaction game that we're going to be playing. So there's going to be improv games. There's going to be a dedicated Q&A to ask any types of questions that you want to any of the people that will be attending. There'll be a live geologic podcast, which I don't think anyone has ever seen. There'll be another game show happening called Is It Mayo? I'm not going to tell you anything else about that. There'll be a live SGU recording. We are going to have a VR headset hooked up, and we're going to be doing some crazy stuff with that and definitely having audience interaction with that. So if you're interested, All you got to do is go to theskepticsguide.org, scroll down a tiny bit, and you'll see a button that will take you to all the information that you need to know. Of course, you're going to have to get a hotel room and all that, so you need all those details. And you can find it out on our page. So just go to our website. I also want to remind you guys that QED, the Skeptical Conference that happens in Manchester, UK, that's happening on September 23rd and 24th. It's coming up quick. Now, last week I said that only patrons can enter, but due to Patreon rules, I need to open this up to the public. So if you are a listener of the SGU and you are able to attend the conference, the QED conference happening on September 23rd and 24th in Manchester, UK, then simply email us at info@theskepticsguide.org with your full name and your current email address that you'd like us to use to let you know if you win. For more information on the conference, you can go to qedcon.org. And I'm going to tell you from personal experience, the conference is awesome and you're going to have a really good time if you go.
All right, thanks, Jay. Okay, guys, it's time for science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Kara, let me ask you a question.
Okay.
How much do you know about volcanoes?
I know a tiny bit.
Okay, good.
Not much.
Because that's the theme this week, volcanoes.
All right. Oh, boy.
Okay, here we go. Item number one. About 30% of the world's population live under potential threat from volcanic activity. Item number two. The Pacific Ring of Fire contains 75% of the world's volcanoes and is the location of 90% of all earthquakes. Item number three. The largest recorded volcanic eruption was Mount Tambora in Indonesia, which killed about 100,000 people and rated a 7 out of 8 on the Volcanic Explosivity Index. Bob, why don't you go first?
Okay, 30% of the population, the world's population, living under threat, volcanic activity. Well, I mean, does that include super volcanoes? Because then I think the number would be even larger. No, so I'm going to say
that includes like active volcanoes, not like a rare events like that. No.
Yeah, it still seems that 30% is high. The Ring of Fire, 75% of the world's volcanoes and 90% of all earthquakes. That doesn't seem right. 90% of all earthquakes. Interesting. Let's see the third one. Mount Tambora, that was the largest, 100,000 people. Largest in what way? In terms of deaths, in terms of explosivity?
Pretty much everything. Yeah, definitely explosivity and deaths.
Wow. I mean, that could be right. I don't know enough about that one to say one way or the other with any certainty here. Yeah, I mean, hard to say between one and two. I just don't know enough to be confident at all. So I'll just toss my coin here and I'll go with the 75% of the world's volcanoes, Ring of Fire.
Fiction. That's a fiction.
Yes.
Okay, Evan?
30% of the world's population live under the potential threat from volcanic activity. Okay, so potential threat. We have to, if we had a better definition of what that meant, then the 30% might be a little clearer. Look, I mean, remember we did Nexus one year and the Iceland, it was 2011, the Iceland volcano blew and that impacted a lot of things going on. So is that considered a threat? Right, it shut down all air traffic in Europe and stuff. I mean, are we talking about loss of human activity or loss of life?
No, direct threat.
Okay, direct
not threat. Indirect consequences of there having been a volcanic explosion.
Okay,
direct threat.
Right, because that would be like 100% of people.
Yeah,
right. Well, change the atmosphere's composition or something. Yeah, you could extend that for sure.
I'm not sure about that one. The second one about the Ring of Fire containing 75% of the world's volcanoes and 90% of all earthquakes. Maybe the earthquakes part is right. I'm not sure about this. Is that where 75% of the volcanoes are? It would be a lot. Wouldn't it be a lot? It would be. But gosh, there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of stuff going in the Atlantic Ocean as well that is not there. Maybe that one's the fiction. Bob, that's the one you said was fiction, right? 75% of volcanoes. And then the last one, the Mount Tambora, Indonesia. Which explosion was this? Was this the one in the late 19th century, the one that like snowed in August or something, or there was one also in the early 19th century. I cannot remember which was which. Was Kilimanjaro's a volcano? Oh my gosh, what am I thinking? It's one of those. Boy, did it kill 100,000 people. It's good. I don't know about these facts. I don't know. I'll say the one about 30% of the world's population is fiction. I don't think that's the right number.
Okay, Jay?
Start with the third one. The largest recorded volcanic eruption was Mount Tambora. I do believe that one is science. Killed 100,000 people. That's amazing. That must have been amazing when that happened. God. The second one here, the Pacific Ring of Fire, saying it contains 75% of the world's volcanoes. You know, I got to say, like, it blows my mind that I have never heard anything about the Pacific Ring of Fire.
Really?
Yep. I don't know. No. It's just one of those things that just slipped through the cracks. I've never heard about it. I can admit that to all of you here openly. So I don't know anything about it, but it sounds like a pretty nasty place if it exists. And then the first one saying 30% of the world's population live under potential threat from volcanic activity. 30%. That's a large percentage. But, you know, there's volcanoes everywhere, you know. And so that doesn't – if anything, I would think that that number might even be low. And I'm going to go with my gut here, and I'm going to say that the first one, the 30%, is the fiction.
Well, that's what I did.
And yeah. Kara.
Jay, you've never heard the song Ring of Fire?
Well, I have, but I thought that was about hemorrhoids.
Oh, no.
Katy
Perry, I think the only one that I feel pretty confident about is the Ring of Fire. The numbers might not be perfect, but I think they're pretty close. And I think that probably what would throw people off here is that the Ring of Fire is like the whole Pacific.
Yeah,
like,
it's not the, tiny. It's the rim.
It's the rim around the Pacific Ocean, which is enormous.
Up,
so it's like all of those
Asia
coastal
and
places.
Down the Americas. Yeah.
It's big. So it's a lot. Alaska. So I could see that one being true. I hate to admit this is like embarrassing that I've never even heard of Mount Tambora. But I do know that there are a lot of pretty destructive Indonesian volcanoes and the history there is brutal. And if this was a super long time ago, I wouldn't be surprised if the death toll was high because, of course, there wouldn't be that many mitigation strategies in place. So the one, yeah, that bugs me is the 30%, because if the vast majority of the world's seismic activity or plate kind of tectonic activity is occurring around the Ring of Fire, if we've got the most risk happening around there, is that 30% of the world's population? I sincerely doubt it. It seems like that number is too high. So I'm going to go with two of the boys and say that that one's the fiction.
Okay, so you all agree on the third one. The largest recorded volcanic eruption was Mount Tambora in Indonesia, which killed about 100,000 people and rated 7 out of 8 on the Volcanic Explosivity Index, or the VEI, as we like to say.
oh, yes, every day.
You guys all think that one is science, and that one is science. That is science.
Wow, brutal.
Yeah, it was brutal. The estimates are 100,000 people, but I've also seen it saying that it killed at least 88,000 people. So that's like the low end of the estimate range, but 100 is kind of like the about average range there. And yeah, the VEI, you know, is a exponential scale, right? Logarithmic scale. So each number is 10 times more powerful than the one before it, just kind of like magnitude scale for earthquakes. And a VEI of 7 is the most powerful volcanic eruption ever recorded. It is estimated that the last time there was a VEI 8, which is the high end of the scale, was 10,000 years ago. There haven't been any in the last 10,000 years. So it had to be more than 10,000 years ago. And yeah, this happened in, when do you think it happened?
19th century.
Yeah, that's correct. You want to be more specific?
No.
1815.
Oh, that was the early 18th. Okay. Yeah.
April 10th, to be precise. April 10th, 1815. Massive, massive explosion. Yeah. Very, very powerful. Okay. Let's move on. I guess we'll go backwards. We'll go to number two. The Pacific Ring of Fire contains 75% of the world's volcanoes and is the location of 90% of all earthquakes. Bob, you think this one is fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. And this one is science. This is science. So yeah, the Ring of Fire. That's probably one of those things you've heard 100 times, but it just never registered because you didn't have anything to anchor it to, you know? Mm-hmm. But it basically goes up the like the west coast of South America and North America across Alaska into Russia and then south to Japan, Korea. Yeah, then across Australia and down to New Zealand. That's the Ring of Fire. And that's where most volcanoes are. And it's, of course, a tectonic phenomenon. It's where the Pacific plates are diving in under the continental plates and pushing up the magma and causing...
We're talking magma.
Yeah. It's at the plate boundaries, basically. And that's what causes it. So, yeah, the Ring of Fire. I found the 90% of all earthquakes to be more surprising, actually. That's why I threw that in.
That's
there.
What made me
90% pick, of all yeah. earthquakes. Right, because there are very small earthquakes, too.
Exactly. Yeah. They're just constantly happening there.
Absolutely. But it's happy. Yeah, there's tons of earthquakes all over the place. But, yeah, so 90% of all earthquakes occur along the Ring of Fire. That's according to National Geographic. So I'm assuming that's correct.
Yeah.
All right. Which means that about 30% of the world's population live under potential threat from volcanic activity. Is the fiction? What's the real number? What do you guys think? Higher
order of magnitude 3 or 300? No, 3%.
Any right? other guesses?
Yeah, 12%.
It's 10%. 10%. Close. 10% of the world's population live under the direct threat of volcanoes. And if you look at the Ring of Fire, you could see, as Kara correctly pointed out, that's a lot of people there. I mean, it goes through Los Angeles and things like that, but there's it's hard to imagine that 30% of the world's population lives in that Ring of Fire. So, yeah, then I just tripled the number. I figured that would be enough. All right. Well, good job, guys.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
Yeah.
All right. Evan, give us a quote.
Insofar as a scientific statement speaks about reality, it must be falsifiable. And insofar as it is not falsifiable, it does not speak about reality. You want to guess who that was?
Yeah, I know.
Carl, I did tell you. Carl Popper. Anytime I see the word falsifiable, Carl Popper is one of them.
Popper, yeah.
pops into my head.
But I feel like I feel like there was a little bit of a misspeaking in this quote.
Okay, explain.
And you say it one more time.
Insofar as a scientific statement speaks about reality, it must be falsifiable. And insofar as it is not falsifiable, it does not speak about reality.
Yeah,
right. Yeah. So I think the important thing is to remember that the second half has parallel structure. He's still referring specifically to scientific statements.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
if you don't specify that, he's not saying that anything that speaks to reality is falsifiable. And if it's not falsifiable, it doesn't speak to reality. He's saying that scientifically, like if it were to be described scientifically.
Yeah, it says the scientific statement.
Yeah.
That carries over to the second half.
The second half, yeah. It's got a parallel structure there.
And
yeah.
he is using a semicolon. It's not two separate sentences. So there's a semicolon that separates the first part and the second part.
But that is,
so,
I think, important to specify.
Yeah.
Well, because the it in the second part refers to a scientific statement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Right, because by definition, you know, being falsifiable is a necessary criterion for being scientific. Mm-hmm. If something's not falsifiable, it may be true, it may not be true, but science has nothing to say about it, because what could you do? You can't you can't falsify it, you can't really test it. Right?
That was one of the very first sort of principles of skepticism I learned back in the 1990s. And when it's like a light went off in my head once that was explained to me. Like, oh my gosh, of course. Yes.
Yeah, because it's one whole category of nonsense, right? It's just one way things evade scientific investigation is they just arrange themselves in such a way that they're not falsifiable. Like creationism, again, since we brought that up earlier in the show. Like evolution could be falsified because evolution makes predictions. If whales evolved from terrestrial mammals, we must find transitional whale species. But creationism makes no such predictions. If you find transitional whale species, well, God just decided to create them. You know, like, and they do say that. You know, anything that we find is compatible with an arbitrary, you know, intelligent designer. It's unfalsifiable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even if it's rock solid proof of evolution, that still doesn't falsify creationism, because the creator could have done anything it arbitrarily desired. Unfalsifiable, not science. All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure, man.
Thanks, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.